Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening and welcome to the program for Friday, April 3rd, 2015. It's the Federal News Countdown. The three most important federal news stories of the week is selected this week and every week by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, my experts are Robert Shea of Grant Thornton. It's great to see you, my friend. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Francis.
And Dave Wintergren of the Professional Services Council. And you're welcome to, thanks for coming on the program today, rookie. It's your first time ever on the Federal News Countdown. I'm glad
to have
you here.
See if I'm trainable.
Yeah, I have every confidence that you're going to be just fine. And Robert, you've brought a guest with you today.
I have.
Introduce your lovely guest to the audience.
The lovely and talented Mimi Shea. Thank you for being with us.
And she's on spring break. And where do you go to school? Get Mimi over there by the microphone. Where do you go to school, darling?
St. Mary's.
And you're in what grade?
Fifth grade.
And you go back to school when?
Next Monday. The Monday after.
Monday after, this coming Monday. That's terrific. And so you're harassing your father the whole time you're on spring break. Is that right?
Maybe.
Well, thank you for the very lovely bag of gifts that you brought. I really appreciate that. It's very kind of you, and it's lovely to have you here. And I'm a huge fan of your dad. And I'm friends with your dad on Facebook, and it's just a delightful to watch you and your sister grow up and become fine young ladies. So welcome to the show, and thank you for being here. We're going to start the countdown where we always do with...
Number three!
And the third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Robert Shea, is from federalnewsradio.com. My colleague Jason Miller's story, headline, Congressman Hurd flashes IT oversight muscle at DHS. And it's my view, at least, that Congressman Hurd's kind of come out of nowhere. He's a first-termer, and all of a sudden he's leading a subcommittee on the House Oversight Committee. I don't think that's traditional or standard operating procedure. And he's got a bill up now that will at least impact the Department of Homeland Security, and it appears that it might go somewhere. Am I off target on any of that,
no,
Robert?
That's right. Texans always have that kind of impact.
not that you're biased or anything.
The new Congress is 4 months old. You're right. A freshman congressman takes the helm of a very important subcommittee, at least in our world. And he's actually got background in the area, former government employee, worked with the CIA, and is making a bit of a splash. You know, priorities include cyber, privacy, how to bring emerging technologies, which, you know, David's work will tell you is hard to adopt in federal agencies. But also giving the Department of Homeland Security a hard time about duplicative IT investments, how to reduce that duplication and save some money.
I was struck when I talked to Congressman Hurd not long after the Congress convened and we learned about his subcommittee, that this is not just a guy who, you know, pounded on Jason Chaffetz enough until he finally gave in and said, okay, I'll give you this so you'll go away. This guy knows the material.
That's right. He's got relevant expertise and background. I'm looking forward to seeing how that works.
What do you expect to see prospect-wise? As this bill proceeds, the Department of Homeland Security IT Duplication Reduction Act, do you think this has a chance to go somewhere? It sounds to me like the kind of thing that winds up getting stuck on some other bill at some point in time. And maybe it's not a flashy signing ceremony or anything, but it eventually comes to pass.
I think that's right. You know, he also sits on the Homeland Security Committee, so that dual jurisdiction gives him a leg up. This is also consistent with a lot of things that are already going on at the department. It might actually give it some legs, some institutionalization to see it enacted. There's a chance.
Robert Chase, third most important federal news story of the week's from federalnewsradio.com. Congressman Hurd flashes IT oversight muscle at DHS. All right, Rook, let's see what you got. I'm in that baseball mode, I guess, because opening day is on Monday.
Do I get to opine on that story, or do I have to go to my number three?
Well, we're going to talk about your number three story, and that is from federalnewsradio.com as well. It's headline, Millennials Leaving Government Over Lack of Innovation Study Finds. And this really gets to, I think, what the more significant problem is in human resources in government, and that is not recruiting millennials, but figuring out how to get them to stay, or at least transition from one agency to another, or be willing to come back in however long they think their career track should bring them back, rather than, I'm frustrated, this isn't what I expected, and I don't expect it to ever change, so I'm never coming back.
Yeah, the surveys show that not only are we having trouble attracting millennial generation workers, but actually getting them to stay. Mm-hmm. They're joining government and staying for a few years and then leaving. But this article really struck me because it gets at this heart of, you know, we have an agenda with this administration that's focused on innovation, and yet innovation is declining. And there's a whole lot of symptoms about that that we need to look at and try to figure out what's going on. We do a survey annually with Grant Thornton, an acquisition workforce survey. And if you ask contracting officers of the government, their lowest priorities are about speed and innovation. Mm-hmm. And so we're incentivizing a system that isn't driving us to get innovation in government the way we should.
Federal News Radio is going to take a look at this very issue in a couple of weeks. We're doing a special report on this program about the workforce that's aging in place. And the title of it's the reverse retirement wave, because it strikes me that, I mean, I've seen some agencies where millennials are leaving in greater numbers than boomers are retiring. And that really is not the situation we want to be in 2020 and 2025 and 2030, having to play catch up like that.
Yeah, we talked about that last week. Mm-hmm. That you have an aging technology workforce that's staying, and new workers are coming in, and they are not finding spots to grow into leadership positions, and so then they're leaving. And you have a corresponding contracting workforce that's very young and inexperienced. And so we're not taking advantage of contracting tools that would bring innovation to our organizations. There are pockets of innovation. It's not like a bad news story, but across the board, you know, the survey talked about 2/3 of the respondents say they don't get rewarded for creativity and innovation, and yet they want to make a difference. And we really need to talk about that some more as a large dynamic about how do you foster innovation.
Jory writes about the Idea Lab concept that's already started at HHS. I understand there are other agencies where they're starting to ramp up. Commerce is one where an effort like that will get underway. But it's a really bad catch-22 situation, because it's really hard to start something new without some demonstration of how it's going to work. And without some demonstration of how it's going to work, it's hard to get budget. And without budget, it turns into that perpetual cycle.
Right. And, you know, the things that you measure are the things that you focus your time and attention on, and we are not incentivizing for innovation. And we sometimes get very confused because we think it's about this person can't be innovative or this company can't be innovative, but it's really a whole lot more about how we ask for things and what kind of behavior do we reward.
Dave Wintergreen's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. Millennials leaving government over lack of innovation study finds, and you can find that story and all of this week's Federal News Countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week, selected by Dave Wintergreen and Robert Shea, next on In Depth with Francis Rose. Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Dave Wintergreen of the Professional Services Council and Robert Shea of Grant Thornton. And, Dave, it's your first time on the Federal News Countdown as we get up to
number two.
And I'm not sure if you know it, but my understanding is that there's a requirement at your office that you have to choose at least one story every week that Stan Soloway's quoted in, and you didn't do that.
I failed miserably.
Yeah, so
and
I'm
it's not,
not
hard.
There's no returning.
That's right.
I'm moving in with you.
And you may have to. But your choice at number two is from the Washington Post. The headline is IBM's making a new business unit just for the Internet of Things. I got to give you credit, because you're the first person that ever talked to me about the Internet of Things. And this was at least 5 years ago, and nobody else was talking. You were still in the Defense Department, and I don't even know if you used the term the Internet of Things, because I don't even know if people were using that term widely yet. Mm-hmm. But you warned me that coming down the road would be this day when everything was connected to the Internet, and what were the implications of that for security and for government operations and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. So I say that only to highlight the fact that this is something that you've been thinking about for a long time. And I wonder how your thinking has progressed over the years as other people have started to think about this, and as we've seen technology advance to the point where these are not just things that are pie in the sky possibilities, but they're actual things that people really want to use and are practical for people to use every day.
Yeah. And so, you know, what you see happen, it's not a new topic. Mm-hmm. I think back to like the last millennium, there was that IBM commercial about the refrigerator, and the repairman comes to the door and they go, hey, your refrigerator is broken. And the people go, I don't know. And this, your refrigerator knows, right? That was like 1999. Mm-hmm. And so this idea about devices being connected and being able to present information from anywhere is not a new subject. But here you got a story about IBM making a multi-billion dollar investment to sort of marry together this idea about sensors are everywhere. Big data is able to be brought together and be able to do analytics on it to create a dramatic result. I also like the story because their anecdote was about weather and 10,000 sensors around the world for weather. And how could you use that weather data for more than predicting school closures? And they landed on the higher temperatures equal greater beer consumption, but not necessarily all around the country. Mm-hmm. It goes up per capita higher in Seattle than Arizona, and that could help you. Mm-hmm. And that's Walmart's business model. They know when a weather event's coming to town what to stock up on. And so for government, what does this mean? I mean, this idea about the way you could collect information in real time and use it to make better decisions is a powerful change.
And one of the changes that we will probably anticipate at some point, Robert, is the idea that some of the things that government does now, they'll have to do dramatically differently, or maybe won't need to do because they'll be able to rely on, use Dave's weather example. Well, at some point in time, maybe it's worth the return on investment for some private sector organization, and I'm just pulling the Weather Channel out of the sky because of the brand awareness, but for them to put their own sensors and predictive equipment in different places rather than relying on what the government does, maybe we find that there's a whole lot of data that the government produces that they don't need to at some point in time.
I do think the emergence of these technologies will produce results that the government's been trying to do for a long time much better, quicker, cheaper. A great example, I think, the governor of Delaware was talking about DUI arrests, they've been investing in police and increased patrols during times when DUIs were high. They noticed a precipitous drop in DUIs. Couldn't figure out, you know, thought that they had finally figured it out. They realized what was the major contributor? Uber. Had nothing to do with their investment in police or the strategies they were employing. It was just a fortuitous thing that Uber happened to emerge, a very easy way to get a ride if you happen to have had too much to drink. I think there'll be a lot of things like this, things that we anticipate and think about, others we couldn't have even imagined, mm-hmm. that emerge that are addressing problems we've been trying to tackle for a long time.
And that really, Dave, is the ultimate disruptive technology example, because it's, you know, who would have seen that coming in that context? And yet so there's no way to plan policy. There's no way to plan allocation of resources around a development like right. that.
And that's the art of it. Can you keep your aperture open wide enough that when the new thing happens, you can actually take advantage of it and use it in ways you never dreamed possible. Mm-hmm. You think about the evolution of 3D printing, and now in Europe, we're building entire multi-story buildings using 3D technology. So it's not just for small little gizmos. It's a way to do supply chain management completely differently if you're in some kind of environment like on a Navy ship.
But the response to those kinds of changes historically is not the kind of response that a government is really good at leveraging.
No, you've really got an iPhone emerging workforce in a BlackBerry world. Mm-hmm. I hate to, it's probably a bad thing to dismiss BlackBerry like that, but I really do think that that's the past, and we've got to look at the future and what these things can give us in terms of tools to manage better.
And that takes us back to your third story, which is the reason behind why millennials don't find the government to be particularly innovative and therefore not particularly attractive as a place to work.
Right, but if we're looking for a bright spot, perhaps it is this very point that both of you have made, that we have a consumer base in terms of a workforce, mm-hmm. that is going to force change because they're used to being able to use technologies to get their job done, and they're going to be relentless. If you don't give them the tools to do their job, they will use their own tools to do the job.
Did you see that at the Defense Department?
I did. And you see this fascinating dynamic. And, we started dabbling with iPads, but we so neutered them that they were just basically PDF readers. And so my staff called mine Dave's Y-Pad. Why would you want one if that's all you could do? And you can say what you want about the security reasons about why that was an okay first step to take, but it's not going to be good enough. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are going to want to be able to use the full range of capabilities here. And while I didn't get to talk about Stan Soloway, I will say that this issue of PSC Service Contractor Magazine Magazine has a whole bunch of stories about the Internet of Things and how it will create this revolution in government. So you could go to the PSC website, www.pscouncil.org, and you'll learn more.
We'll link that. That's a terrific reference. And Dave Wintergreen's choice is the second most important federal news story of the week. Is from the Washington Post, the headline, IBM's making a new business unit just for the Internet of Things. Robert, your choice at number two this week is from the Washington Post as well. The headline is, America's National Libraries Lacking in Leadership, Yet Another Report Finds. This is the Library of Congress, and the story starts out, the lead here just lays it out pretty well. The federal government's watchdog agency released a critical report Tuesday on the Library of Congress's longstanding failures to manage the complex computer systems that are vital to its mission. Librarian of Congress James Billington has ignored repeated calls to hire a chief information officer as required by law. So there's two things. I don't know Mr. Billington, and I'm sure he's, by all other accounts, a fine leader. He's been there for a long time. I don't know anything about his tenure there. But number one, it's the law. He's supposed to have a CIO. And number two, it's a really, really good idea to have a CIO. And so I guess of all of the issues that the GAO pointed out in this story, those two things are the things that seem to me to be the most obvious and the least easy to excuse.
Yeah, well, not to geek out on you, but what fascinated me was the institutional combat here, the fact that you had a legislative branch entity, GAO, criticizing another legislative branch entity, the Library of Congress, for GAO to be so public, to be so direct about a peer organization's. It had to be pretty serious.
Mm-hmm.
And they are calling out the capacity of this particular leader to manage the organization. And as evidence of that, his fundamental misunderstanding of what it takes to manage a large organization's IT portfolio. In the scheme of the federal government, this is not a huge organization. It's nonetheless one of the largest, most complex, most historic organizations in the world.
The among its 31 proposed remedies, you've seen a lot of GAO reports in your time, I'm sure, Dave. I don't know if you've ever seen one before that had 31 recommendations. The report instructs Billington to, quote, expeditiously hire a chief information officer and create policies to track costs, improve security, and respond to customer complaints. I mean, that's quite a line of business there that's not being attended to.
It's pretty basic stuff. And when you listen to look at the list of things they want the organization to do, they're the sorts of things that you should have been doing years and years ago.
Yeah.
I was delighted that Robert picked this story because, I mean, it seems like it's not a true story. I mean, how could you possibly be an information age organization and not have an information leader, you know?
And the organization is impactful, right? In addition to having this grand set of buildings housing a great collection of books, it also is the place at which copyrights are issued. So all original work is registered there and protected by it.
Mm-hmm.
That role is enshrined in the Constitution. And then, of course, you've got the Congressional Research Service, which, as a former congressional staffer, was an undeniably important asset in getting your job done. But yet they can't, you know, they told GAO they had 18,000 personal computers when, in fact, when they did an inventory, found only to have 6,500. The number of systems was first listed at 30 and then another tally at 46. But then when the Library of Congress came up with another inventory, it was really 70. The right hand does not know what the left hand is doing here. And it's just gotten so bad that we had to have this major story.
And I, like you, Francis, I don't know the individual, you know, and so I'm sure there are great attributes about his leadership style, but in this space, I mean, we would have to declare leadership lacking. I mean, these are fundamental responsibilities for a knowledge-based organization to be a leader on, not just a late adopter or a non-adopter of. And you know what the saying goes, Larry Bossidy once said, you know, leaders get the behaviors that they exhibit and tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're leading a knowledge-based organization, you need to be an exemplar of how to do knowledge-based work.
And a little bit of background that this story has on Mr. Billington. Russia scholar appointed by Ronald Reagan, who doesn't use email and rarely a cell phone, and who critics say has done nothing to fix the library's ongoing problems. At 85, Billington is the oldest of the 13 executives who have led the agency since its founding in 1800. I mean, with all due respect to my friends and colleagues in his age cohort, maybe this just isn't a priority to him because he's not a digital native. Maybe it just doesn't matter that much.
Well, the article is very colorful in some of the ways it describes his competence, frankly. And I'm sure he's an immense scholar and a great librarian. But we're not talking about a library. We're talking about something that's at the apex of the information revolution. It really, the collection that that place has and the functions that it perform are astounding. I mean, you've got the place that's copywriting all of major new developments, creative developments, in the same place that's housing the Declaration of Independence, which has Thomas Jefferson's handwritten edits. That's a major import that deserves real leadership.
But that's sort of the cusp of the article, because imagine that he is just super at the rest of his job. This would be why you would want an information leader. I have worked for more than one leaders in my life that, you know, weren't technology leaders themselves. That's why you should have a CIO. That's why you should have somebody to help take care of those issues and help remind you of what's important and how to take your organization to the next level.
Well, and it seems to me, too, the deeper story, I think you're right about that exactly, Dave. But the deeper story here to me is the conversation that I've had with each of you separately, which is the concept of hiring or promoting someone because of their technical excellence when they don't necessarily demonstrate leadership, talent, or skill or experience. And I don't know if that's the case here. I'm not speaking specifically about Mr. Billington, but you said he may be a great librarian, Robert. That's true. That doesn't necessarily make somebody the great sales guy is not necessarily a great sales manager.
That's right. His good friend says he's a great admirer of Billington. A manager, he's not.
Well,
yeah, and plus, since we're talking about legislative branch conversation, it would be good to point out that, you know, there's help that could be given to organizations like these too, because we have a set of statutes that have sort of really become dense in the information technology space and often have been layered upon each other since the Clear-Cohen Act over the last 20 years. And it's time to sort of sweep that clean and think about what technology legislation should look like for the 21st century, about how things should be done in a digital age. And you know, the more that you just layer on reporting requirements as opposed to outcomes that you expect to achieve, the more that you create an environment that won't demand the kind of people that you want to get the work done.
Robert Chase, second most important federal news story of the week from the Washington Post. The headline is America's National Libraries Lacking in Leadership, Yet Another Report Finds. It's about the Library of Congress, and you can find it and all of our stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. The most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Robert Chase and Dave Winogrand when the federal news countdown continues on In Depth with Francis Rose. This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Dave Winogrand and Robert Shea, and we are up to
number one.
The top of the chart, and Dave, your choice at number one is from the Wall Street Journal. The headline is Obama Unveils New Penalties for Overseas Cyber Attacks. And while I think it is useful that we have guidance from the White House on this, it underscores in my mind the idea that we still don't have a real definition of what constitutes a cyber attack, on whom, and what the appropriate response is. I understand there are a lot of variables, and this is a hard problem, and I don't mean to discount that, but we still aren't there yet.
Yeah, I picked this story for two reasons. One, because it speaks to the fact that this is an ever-increasing issue of national imperative, and here you have a step being taken in the direction of how do you deter and or retaliate. It's a fairly public statement about, you know, if you're an overseas entity and you're hacking into us, we're going after you, right? But it also speaks to how much still needs to be done. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of tepid bipartisan support, but of course it had to be done in the context of, but we have so much work to be done. You think about the issues here about information sharing. How does the private sector share with the public sector so that we know when bad things are happening and we don't punish people who are doing due diligence but still get hacked? Mm-hmm. How do we create a nation that's savvy cyber consumers? How do we create the cybersecurity workforce of the future? There is so much that needs to be done in this space. And so I was delighted to see us starting to take steps. But as you point out, there is so much more that needs to be done.
Taking steps is good. And I agree with Dave's point on that. I wonder, though, if it's not possible to move more quickly. If say, North Korea, a group of people representing the North Korean government, Robert, came to the United States and broke into the headquarters of Sony Pictures and took physical material out, there'd be no question there would be some kind of retaliation on our part. And we did see retaliation on, or a response, I should call it, to the Sony Pictures hack. But that was probably the first time that we saw something that we know of, that we can, that people outside the government can confidently say, yeah, that probably happened because that happened. And it strikes me that we're very long into the cyber game where these responses that we at least know that they're happening are happening.
I agree with you that we're not really equating cyber crime with other crime. If somebody robs a bank, there's an all points bulletin, the pictures are posted, and people are on the chase for that person. It's not, you know, the number of attacks you get in cyber, the number of emails I get that say, if you could just send me some money, I'll give you the rest of my money when I get back from Nigeria. It's you know, what tactics do people employ in those situations? I'm sure there is a sea of things going on that we're not aware of. I'm sure this is an area in which our intelligence community is working very hard. And doing a lot of things that we would be proud of but can't know. But I still don't think as a nation, as a culture, we really equate cybercrime in the same way we should physical crime, even though I think in many cases cybercrime is probably a lot more harmful.
Dave, I'll play devil's advocate on myself. Is it possible that the reason we haven't been able to move any faster is because it's not possible to move any faster, or maybe some of these issues are so complex and so complicated and technology advances at a rate that's faster than we're able to think about policy to apply to them, that maybe some of these issues will never be solved in the way that folks would like to see them solved, or at least dealt with, thought about, analyzed?
Yeah, I don't think it's a problem that you can ever say you've gotten ahead of.
Right.
And I would say, for the purposes of today, we should probably set aside some of the retaliation, attack, exploit kind of part of cyber world, because it's tough to do attribution, and it's whether it's international, domestic, and channels, and where did it come from, and how do you respond, all those sorts of things. But even if you set aside the how would you respond to the cyber incident, we are just woefully prepared to actually be prepared for the cyber incident. And so these issues about it, you know, the National Academy of Public Administration, we're doing a study on what are the performance metrics that you should have in place for cybersecurity education in universities. There are Centers for Academic Excellence that are in a program with NSA and DHS, and it's wonderful. But do we have the right kind of measures to see that we're grooming a cybersecurity workforce? So we have a lot of work that we could do to have a better cybersecurity workforce and government industry. We have a lot of work we should be doing about how do we protect the citizenry? How do we make sure that companies are able to report when bad things happen to them and not be punished? Because, you know, it happens to everybody. And so you got to have the, you know, if you did your due diligence, do you have a way to be able to share information so we can get ahead of these attacks? Mm-hmm. Right. And so there's so much that can be done, even not trying to get ahead of the complicating factors that you bring up.
Is that stigma in your mind starting to dissipate at all, or is it still pretty prevalent?
No, I'm very concerned about it. I watched, you know, if Company A goes, you know, I've been hacked, and then we go, well, then therefore we should terminate your contract. Whereas, you know, federal agency gets hacked and we go, well, whoops.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's one thing if an organization is failing to do good hygiene.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But there's a different issue about, you know, bad things are happening. And the more we're able to share information so we can see patterns of behavior and see things as they're happening, the more we could help protect each other.
Mm. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dave Wintergrins from The Wall Street Journal. The headline is Obama unveils new penalties for overseas cyber attacks. That story and all of our stories in the countdown posted at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week is selected by Robert Shea. We'll wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. It's the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. On Federal News Radio, the three most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Dave Wennergren and Robert Shea. And Robert Shea's most important story of the week is from Bloomberg Government. The headline is Budget Conference, Disputes Over Medicare, Spending, and Policy. And, I mean, that's pretty much the big three when it comes to the conference that we'll see between the House and Senate. What did you see as this story does a very nice job, I think, of detailing the differences between the budget resolutions in the House and Senate. The 800-pound gorilla in the room is the overseas contingency operation budget. The Senate does not put all their defense spending additions into the OCO like the House does, but this story goes over a lot of other differences. Were there others that jumped out at you besides the OCO, Robert?
Well, no apologies, but you can take the boy out of OMB, but you can't take the OMB out of the boy. So
you geeked out when you saw this. That's
budget,
fair.
It's a budget story. Budget is what runs this town. And the good news is we've got budgets out of both the House and the Senate. That hadn't happened in a while. And there's a commitment to get them reconciled before the April 15th deadline. That'll be tough. But furthermore, there is a big number that both the House and the Senate require other congressional committees to go and find. So, and that's reconciliation. We haven't seen a budget reconciliation process. A lot of policy, a lot of savings are expected to be produced by the action of authorizing committees in every area. I guess the House asks all committees to work on it. The Senate just focuses on two.
The note here that the passage in this story that I liked is the top line number for appropriations 2016, the level already the same in both budgets, $1.12 trillion, including war and disaster funds. The optimist in me says that's good because that just means they agree on the numbers. It now becomes a matter of where they fall. And I don't mean to oversimplify that and undersell the complexity of it. I know that's hard, Dave. But it's a lot better than we've seen in probably, what, the last half decade to decade.
Yeah, but is anybody struck by the fact that you have sequestration looming and you have a president's budget that busts the Budget Control Act caps going out through the future years? You have, on both defense and non-defense, you have a House budget that busts the caps for the defense side, trying to compensate for it on the non-defense side. And so, you know, at some point, there's got to be this moment of awakening that, you know, that we got to do something about it. We got to do something about the Budget Control Act and the sequestration. And because otherwise, we're presenting numbers that don't work because you got to do the across-the-board prorated cuts.
Does the Hill person in your background, Robert, give you any indication that it's possible that the BCA could be repealed or cut off at some point?
I mean,
because everybody's, not everybody, there is a cohort of members in the House in particular that is just fine with the BCA the way it is. But beyond that group, nobody else seems to have much love for it anymore.
No, that's right. Because it does, it's like idiot budgeting. Anybody can cut across the board. It takes a more sophisticated approach to actually target those cuts to either unpopular programs or programs that don't work. So I do expect to see some relief on sequestration, if not total. But you also have a structural budget problem going out much longer in the future that needs to be dealt with. There's some mandatory savings, but until those mandatory programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, are fixed structurally, then we're going to continue to have a real struggle to get budgets passed.
We have no reason to believe that that's possible at all between now and January 20th, 2017. That will have to be a new president who's involved with that kind of a conversation, yeah, don't you think?
I love Robert's optimism, and I'm really keeping my fingers crossed that he's right. You know, I'll just tell you a cautionary tale, though. You know, when we've done successful base closure legislation, the reason why it's worked is because it's taken out of the hands of individual congressmen and senators the ability to be blamed for what comes out of it. And so, you know, there is that converse argument, if you're a cynic, that says cross the board cuts absolve you of blame for the, you know, having to make the hard choices. And so you're right. I mean, if you look at what happened in 2013, you know, DOD suffered greatly because of sequestration in terms of readiness. And so, you know, across the board cuts are not the way to go. And granted, in 2016, it's not quite as bad. It's just a lack of an increase that we want rather than a decrease again. But if we don't fix it, it's going to cause huge problems across government.
But this budget presumes that it's fixed, at least on the defense side, right? The defense side plusses up the president's request substantially to an equal number on both the House and the Senate. So I think that foreshadows a fix, if you will, on sequestration.
Yeah, we can hope.
I want to go back to the idea of the OCO budget that I brought up at the beginning of this segment. And I thought it was noteworthy that Chairman Enzi in the Senate side chose not to go that way. I had two former DOD comptrollers on the program back in, I want to say, late January, early February, Dov Zakheim and Bob Hale. And I asked them both that question. What if, this was before we had any idea this is what the House was actually going to do, what if they did it that way? And both of them said that'd be a really bad idea. Of course, this is what we wind up getting from Chairman Price on the House side. And I wonder if that's what we wind up seeing, what impact that might have, first of all, on the whole discussion about the BCA, because technically you've cheated successfully. The Chairman Price's budget on the House side does come in at BCA caps and sticks all the extra defense spending on the OCO side. So, I mean,
it's a gimmick.
That point,
it's a gimmick, plain and simple.
Sure, it is, and I don't even know if he's denied that it's a gimmick. He probably has, but I haven't heard it. Yes, it's a gimmick, but it technically, by the letter of the law, they're able to get away with it.
The flexibility for a national emergency has to be there, but it becomes like an addiction. And it's a way, as you said, to like avoid having to make hard choices. And I think that, you know, I worked with Bob Hill. I think he would say when he was there, he wanted to be able to make the tough choices.
Yep.
Rather than having an arbitrary thing given to you or being propped up temporarily and then have it pulled away.
And the addictive is a good word for it. My friend Gordon Adams at American University, who was at OMB in the Clinton administration and did this stuff there, wrote a column about it, called it crack cocaine, Robert, because you get hooked on it and you don't ever want it to go away.
That's right. It's like a home equity loan, right? People think it's free money, but it'll come home to roost.
I note here that the very last one is a point that I have championed for a long time, being a stamp and coin geek from way back. This mentions the dollar coin. The Senate budget includes a provision intended to ease passage of legislation that would eventually replace dollar bills with dollar coins. It would take into account the savings over time from using more durable materials when scoring the bill. Chairman Enzi hails from a mining state and has long championed the dollar coin. I saw a picture recently. Did you post this?
I did.
Yes, I thought it was you. There's a picture I saw on Facebook.
$1.36 billion in unused metal dollars in the Fed.
So that's 1.36 billion coins.
That's right.
That are just there.
This is a quest that has continually failed. I don't think that's a good reason to say it shouldn't continue to be tried, but paper dollars don't seem to go away.
You know who did it right? Canada did it right. Canada.
And you don't often say that.
No, I haven't said that often on this program. That's true. Canada did it right. They declared a date certain that their dollar notes would no longer be valid currency. And said, if you don't use them by this point, they didn't say collector's items, but essentially they become collector's items and you convert to the dollar coin and you didn't have a choice. And it worked so well that they did the same thing. That it used to be that $2 bills were used up there a lot too. And they did the same thing with $2 bills and they converted to $2 coins. So the lowest note now in Canada is $5.
Maybe that's the way to do it.
This is a classic Washington story, though, uh-huh. Because the first sentence is, there's a moral high ground of why to do this. From the person that has a mining district.
Yeah.
Such a classic Washington
story. Yeah. Well, and I think it's a classic Washington story for many reasons, because there's no possible way to do a cost-benefit analysis of this, to do a business case for it and say we should keep printing dollar bills. It's not possible. And yet, for all of these various reasons, that we continue. All right, back to the real serious budget issues here. Robert, 30 seconds. Do you see appropriated bills at least available for voting by September 30th?
Yes. I mean, we'll have a continuing resolution that'll extend us beyond the date, but I think you'll see more bills passed through each House of Congress than you've seen in a long time.
Same question to you, Dave. Glass half full or half empty?
I'll defer to my expert next to me here. I was going to say, for sure, continuing resolution, at least one of them.
Yeah.
Perhaps two or more.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Robert Shea, is from Bloomberg Government. Budget conference calls for disputes over Medicare spending and policy and dollar coins. And you can find that and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dave, a terrific maiden voyage on the Federal News Countdown.
It was wonderful. I enjoyed it.
He did pretty good, didn't he?
He did great.
And I can come back?
Yes, you absolutely will be invited back. If I let Trotkin come back, I certainly will let you come back.
Yeah. I want a recording of this.
Right. Oh, we've got it on. There's plenty of tape that we've got on this show. It's great to see you as always, Robert. It's great. Thanks for coming back. And thank you for bringing your lovely daughter. It's great
thank
to have her with
much.
Us, too.
I told Mimi we'd have fun with two of the nicest guys in Washington, and I was
and
right.
And we showed up anyway. So it's great to have you. The Federal News Countdown is back next Friday on In Depth with Francis Rose. All the stories and the program archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.